Hi, you're listening to the Professionals Playbook, a podcast that brings transparency to top performers, careers, and topics. My name is Justin Hazard Lee. I'm an F-35 fighter pilot for the Air Force. The goal of this podcast is to find experts who are at the top of their field to share their insights based on credibility and experience. My guest today is Scott Mann, who spent 23 years in the United States Army, 18 of those as a Green Beret in Army Special Forces, where he specialized in unconventional missions in Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Panama, Iraq, and Afghanistan. He is the author of two international best-selling books, Game Changers and Straight Talk About Military Transition. He's also given three TED Talks. In our conversation, we talk about how Green Berets build rapport with local tribes, how he almost took his life after leaving the military, and how leaders can connect with their people. Today's episode is brought to you by Bremont, over-engineered watches for professionals. In the last few years, Bremont has taken over as the fighter pilot's watch. Their combination of precision, quality, and customer service is unmatched. You can see all their watches by going to Bremont.com. Also, I've designed a t-shirt to go along with the podcast. It was initially just for friends and family, but I've decided to offer it on my website. It's an F-35 cresting Camelback Mountain here in Arizona. I'm happy with it, and if you see me out, there's a good chance I'll be wearing it. 10% also goes to the Veterans Heritage Project, a nonprofit that connects students with veterans. You can find it on my website at professionalsplaybook.com. If you're looking to keep up with me, you can find me on Instagram at JustinFighterPilot. For more in-depth content, you can sign up for my monthly newsletter. That's at professionalsplaybook.com. Now, without further ado, Scott Mann. All right, Scott, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Justin. Appreciate it.
So I'm curious, how are you using all this training that you've developed over the years and trained to in today's kind of current crazy situation with the coronavirus?
That's an awesome question. That was the question I asked myself when this started to present itself, was how can I and my team take our miles, our scars that we've been through in combat and make it available to a new group of people in the fight. I mean, there's a new group of warriors here at home that are in the fight. So one of the ways that we're really leaning in at Rooftop Leadership is we are working to become knowledge brokers, catalysts of information on leading through chaos. That's our mantra right now in this crisis, is to help people lead through chaos, because that's a different thing than most people at home are used to. I think the other thing that we are doing is our specialty in Rooftop Leadership is having deeper impact through better human connections. That's what Green Berets do. We make connections, and then with those connections, we mobilize people to take action. So I'm focusing on how can we help leaders here at home, whether they're moms, dads, educators, healthcare workers, or business people, make better connections in this very difficult realm of social distancing. Mm-hmm. How can we use human connection in spite of that to close the gap and navigate these challenges? So those would be my top two.
Yeah, there's a lot of fog and friction going on right now. And in the military, we're used to that. And you guys, especially in the Green Beret, can you talk to what you guys did in the Green Beret? I think it'd be good to just go over an overview of what the Green Berets are and what their mission is.
Yeah, and there's a lot of special operations units in the military, and many folks have seen versions of them on the big screen, on TV series. Most people, when they think about special operations, they obviously think of Navy SEALs or Delta. They think of these Rangers, these door-kicking surgical action groups that go in and get the bad guys. Green Berets do some of that, Justin. But Green Berets are different. That's the nickname of U.S. Army Special Forces. Our specialty is to actually parachute in below the noise, and then we drop into very, very dangerous, trust-depleted places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and we connect with village elders, tribal chiefs, indigenous people, and we build relationships with them. So we get surrounded on purpose, basically, with 12-person teams. We build these relationships. And then when the relationships are strong enough, we help the little guy stand up against the big guy. It's kind of a Lawrence of Arabia meets Magnificent Seven. That's what we do that's very, very different. We're relationship-based connectors. We just happen to have a degree of lethality if we need to use it. But usually it's mobilizing indigenous people to fight alongside us. So we might go in with 12 and then ride out with 12,000.
Yeah, I can remember flying missions in Afghanistan, some overwatch for those ANSOF missions. And for listeners, that's the Afghan Special Forces. And there would be just a few Green Berets and there'd be like 200 ANSOF soldiers and you guys would be raiding a town. Raid a town. So what's that like to go into a village that they haven't had communication with Americans ever and start building that rapport?
Well, it's very, very challenging in the sense that typically the places we go by definition are at-risk communities who are marginalized and trust depleted. They are exploited by bad actors because they have societal problems that have caused them to fail as a community. And then bad actors come in and exploit that. So as you can imagine, when we roll in, we're living there. We live among those people. We grow our beards out. We wear the clothes they wear. We live and work among them, which is very, very difficult because now you're at a persistent risk of an insider attack or, you know, someone slitting your throat when you're sleeping. You're more exposed than an in and out kind of target hit in many ways. And you are now actively competing for the same human terrain that the bad guys need to be an insurgent. So that explains why special forces at only 6,500 people have endured more post 9/11 killed in action than all special operations forces combined. And it's because we have just, and you know, it's not that the other guys aren't doing high risk missions. They are. It's just that our exposure level is, you know, persistent. So it's hard. You go into these trust depleted places and you have to make a connection in 5-10 minutes or you're dead. And so it's all about having that baseline surgical lethality, but also leading with a sense of human connection and old school interpersonal skills. And it's this weird cocktail. I tell people, Justin, that a Green Beret in the modern times is like a combination of John Wick, Lawrence of Arabia, and the Verizon guy. You know, I mean, you've got to have lethality, you've got to have human connection skills, and then the Verizon guy, you know, or Sprint guy or whatever he is, he used to walk around on those commercials going, "Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me?" And you build these connections across various gaps that can mobilize against a problem set. So it's a real weird eclectic connection, and it requires everything from lethality to collaboration.
Yeah, I'd imagine that's a difficult skill set to find because I'm sure there are people gung-ho, ready to kick down doors, and then you have people that are more intellectual, but finding somebody that can go across that range is difficult to find.
Yeah, and you have to toggle. You know, every situation is different. I still teach at the Special Forces Qualification Course. And one of the things that's exciting about this, and I think it pertains to your audience as well, is that what we've learned is like, you know, Green Berets have been around since the 50s. We've been around a long time. And we used to think that the ability to go into these places and build rapport and know when to transition between lethality and a handshake was all instinct, right? And that, so we would select a psychological profile and then you train that person and either they have it or they don't. But what we've learned since our ability now in the neuroscience realm to go in and actually monitor brain activity and watch how the brain reacts to like storytelling, active listening, rapport building, physical presence. We know now that there's a science to human connection that we can train on and get better at. And that's really good news because the reality is we're still just as primal and just as Neanderthal-like as we were 250,000 years ago, we just dress better. So the more we can build out this realm of human connection, the more we can move people to take action. And I think that both for special forces and these rough places and here at home, that's sorely needed.
So what are some of those skills when you're meeting the people? Like, I'm sure you have to do a lot of research on what they're local customs and courtesies are.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, the first thing is I call it homework before the legwork, is you really have to work on understanding the first special ops imperative. We have these imperatives that we follow, is understand your operational environment, right? So if I'm going to go to Bogota, Colombia, and I'm going to work with the counter drug police there, the Fuerzas Especiales, you know, I need to do a ton of like 6 months worth of homework, not just at a macro level on Colombia, but I'm going to work at a micro history level. I'm going to look at, you know, indigenous groups, in groups, out groups, relationships, historical trends. I really want to understand the human terrain, and that understanding, talking to third parties, maybe going down on a site survey, so that I can really get surrounded on purpose. I can immerse myself in that area. That's the first thing I have to do, is really put a premium on understanding the human terrain where I'm going to be working. And then once we get into that area, it's all about, you know, early on establishing rapport, but also a level of respect. So there's red lines established that people know that, hey, don't try to cross us. Don't try to take us out. You know, we can give it as good as we get it. So you establish a level of respect without being ridiculously coercive. And then moving into the rapport world, where you are able to understand the pictures in the heads of the people you're there to help and articulate what those pictures are and see how you can be relevant to their pain and to their goals. And then working alongside them to help them stand up on their own. And, you know, that's old school interpersonal skills, but with that Verizon guy outreach to other constituents that can come in, whether it's hydrologists or tribal experts or food insecurity experts, bringing them to bear on the problem. So as you can see, a Green Beret is a catalyst, a connector, and a catalyst for solving wicked problems.
What are some various deployments that you've been on, and how have they differed?
So in the 90s, I was in 7th Special Forces Group most of my career. I was in 23 years, 18 of that as a Green Beret. In the 90s, 7th Special Forces Group primarily worked the Andean Ridge. So we were operating down there during the heavy period of the drug wars. And so I did a lot of deployments to Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, working with the host nation countries, military and law enforcement, on how to bolster their activities against counter drug or drug, you know, narcos and insurgents. And then after Escobar died, they became narco insurgents. And so helping them run counter drug, counter insurgent activities was a big part of my life in the 90s. And then 9/11, almost all of my work moved to Afghanistan, working with primarily tribes that were Pashtun tribes, helping those tribes stand up on their own against the Taliban. I wrote a book about it called Game Changers, and it was basically, again, kind of a Magnificent Seven thing, where we immersed ourselves in 113 villages and helped the locals fight back against the insurgents who were intimidating them.
Yeah, I think I read that you were actually part of the architect team that came up with the strategy for the Afghan war. Can you talk to that?
Yeah, I had done 2 deployments prior to that, Justin, 05 and 06, 07. And to be honest with you, Al-Qaeda, you know, when they attacked us on 9/11, like many Americans and like many American warriors, I was pretty much bent on walking as many of them down as I could and hunting them. And, you know, one of my best friends, Cliff, my Ranger buddy, was killed in the Pentagon on 9/11. And, you know, I became just consumed with attrition. And, you know, while we did some by, with, and through work with indigenous people from 01 to 2010, really, as a community, we didn't do as much as we could have. We were focused on targeting the enemy. And it was in 2009, 2010 that we realized we were losing the war. There were more Taliban in the rural areas than when we started. And so, and there was already talk of us leaving. So we needed a new strategy. And a handful of us, including myself, were selected to design and implement a plan that would get our Green Berets back out into these rural areas, helping locals stand up for themselves. So we got back to our roots, and I was fortunate enough to help design that strategy and then have the opportunity to help implement it.
Yeah, it's such a tough problem, especially in Afghanistan. Everybody is so tribal. There's not one central brain out there. Do you just send teams to every single village and just rinse, repeat?
No, because there's something like 35,000 villages in Afghanistan. So that's, you know, that's an insurmountable problem. What we did figure was we could look at where, because, you know, just like anywhere else, there's a human terrain reality. There's a local reality to every situation. There's a rhythm to it. And so if you look at Afghanistan, what we did in 2010 was for the first time, we got deep on the micro history and we understood that what we had come in Afghanistan and done in the first 10 years was actually counter to how Afghanistan had functioned for centuries as a society. In other words, for centuries in Afghanistan, where the pavement ended or where the, you know, the well-maintained roads ended, so did the government. And what you had were these bottom-up informal civil society organizations that ran their own affairs. And the bulk of those were Pashtun communities in the South and the East. And this insurgency was a Pashtun-dominated insurgency. So what we needed to do was understand how these communities handled their own affairs prior to the Soviets coming, because the Soviets knew enough to dismantle it. And then how could we help restore that resilience through a bottom-up community engagement system and allow them to stand up on their own and get back to doing what they had done. And it was really hard, Justin, because most of the elders, starting with the Soviets, had been targeted and killed. So we had to relearn how tribal society functioned and then create kind of a safety bubble around those communities long enough for those resilient leaders to start to get back in the game. And our bet was that if we picked the most salient ones and the ones that were asking for help, then it would have kind of a domino effect. And it did. We started with six villages. And by the time, you know, that was in the winter of 2010. By the time we hit summer, there were 113 villages and it was really moving fast. So had we not abandoned the program a couple of years later, I think we would see a very different Afghanistan right now.
How difficult was that from a leadership perspective? Because I think you were a lieutenant colonel at the time, and I'm sure you had a bunch of people under you going to different villages. How difficult was that as a leader?
It was extremely challenging. And to be clear, at the time, I was the program manager. So I was not a commander. You had various commanders around the country, but yet I owned the program. And so my job was to, you know, facilitate implementation and to coordinate implementation in new areas and to ensure that we were pushing new teams in country. There was a surge going on. You had to communicate to congressional officials and resources, you know, funding needs. And it was very difficult because it was a wicked problem, Justin. I mean, it was an ill-structured, ill-defined problem, much like we're facing with this virus today. And you had so many constituents, and not one of those constituents, whether it was a Green Beret commander or a congressman or someone from State Department, not one of them had autonomy of the problem. So you had to bring all these dogs and cats together, and you had to get reporting from the field in these very remote, isolated villages that was accurate and timely and really was so the support went from the top, but the demand signal came from the bottom. And so how did you weave all that together into a functioning tribe? And that was, you know, what I wrote Game Changers about. And frankly, we did what we're doing in this virus, which was remote communications. You talk about, you know, social distancing, we had it. And that was the hardest part to me, was traversing these cultural gaps between agencies and organizations, connecting top to bottom, bottom to top, and side to side, and building a functioning network that could talk to itself and respond and tame this wicked problem of Afghan instability and help locals stand on their own in a way that they could survive.
Were you using a lot of technology to model the connections? Because I'm sure you're doing a lot of interpersonal stuff and technology is not really involved in that, but in terms of modeling the connections and figuring out the best centers of gravity to go after.
Yeah, you know, Green Berets first, I think brought in a level of technology integration of, you know, we saw in the first iteration of invading Afghanistan, folks might remember the images of bearded guys on horses. Those were Green Berets for the most part. And so they were combining, as Donald Rumsfeld, our Secretary of Defense, then said, was what I think he called it 19th century cavalry warfare and surgical strikes from guys like yourself, you know, flying missions. So you had literally a Green Beret on horseback doing a cavalry charge, and then he would would call in a precision munition from one of your aircraft. And, you know, that was unprecedented in the field of warfare. And so that trend continued. I think the next, and I'm getting to the answer on your question of how we use technology, was a guy named Stan McChrystal, General Stan McChrystal, through his special ops unit that was hunting terrorists, ushered in, you know, use of video technology that leveraged the agency, that leveraged State Department, that leveraged geographic combatant commanders all across the globe to get in front of the foreign fighter pipeline. I was fortunate enough to be involved in that for a while. And so General Scott Miller and myself, we brought that technology into the village stability world. And we pushed these standalone satellite capable video conferences down to the village sites. And there was a big gnashing of the teeth in the special forces community because we like to be left alone. We like to go out and, you know, tap out our report on Morse code once a day, grow our beard out, and I'll see you in 6 months. But now we were asking these team leaders and these teams to come up on a basically Hollywood Squares video chat and share their perspective on water issues in their village with General Petraeus and maybe even people back in Congress. And at first it was met with a lot of resistance. But I'll tell you, brother, once we started doing that in earnest, it changed everything. And our ability to move faster than the Taliban and to help locals stand up became very powerful. So it was a combination of collaboration, old school interpersonal skills, and using that technology that had been ushered in by, you know, JSOC and others, but now used for stability ops.
Are there any stories that stand out from your time being deployed?
Yeah, you know, there's quite a few. I think the ones that stand out to me are always, you know, actually, okay, so I'll answer it this way. There are so many stories that stand out to me, Justin, that when I came back from the war, I was having a very hard time transitioning. In fact, I almost took my own life a couple of years into it. And had it not been for my middle son walking into the house when he did from school unexpectedly, I probably would have. And it saved my life. And, you know, that's not a story that I like to tell. I told it for the first time in a TED Talk this past November. But what it ultimately led to was sharing that story of that dark period of my life with another veteran and then another. And it caused me to start a nonprofit called The Hero's Journey that helps warriors find their voice and tell their story when they come home. And there were so many stories that I had of brothers, you know, they didn't make it home, man. They didn't come home. And because of the way they lived their life and the missions they ran, the world didn't know what they had given up. And so it haunted me. And my oldest son, Cody, is about to go in the Army as an infantryman. And I just thought, damn, we're 20 years into this war. You know, I really want people to understand what it is that our warriors do every day in their families. And so I ended up, with the help of a couple of mentors, writing a play called Last Out, Elegy of a Green Beret. And then if that midlife crisis wasn't enough, decided to become an actor and performed it with a group of veterans. And we've taken it on tour for, you know, a year now. It's got the attention of Tom Brokaw, CBS News. They're going to show it on Fox Nation on May 22nd. But I know that's probably not the answer you were expecting, but there were so many stories that I needed to tell them from the stage. And there's so many amazing things that my brothers in the special forces and the SEALs and their families endured that, you know, I couldn't tell them all at once. So I put them in a play.
Yeah. I think the mental health aspect is a often overlooked casualty, the casualties from the mental health of war. I can, as a fighter pilot, we go fly our missions and we come back, we need long runways and a lot of infrastructure. But even after those missions, I could feel pretty anxious, and it would take me a little while to go ahead and recover from them. I started meditating out there and it helped out. But for somebody who's in the mud, who doesn't have an opportunity to kind of distance themselves from it, I think it can be extremely tough. Is that what led to you almost killing yourself?
I think it was the fact that I came home in transition and I did not bring with me my relevance and my purpose that I had been so passionate about. I mean, I wanted to become a Green Beret when I was 14 years old. Like it was, and probably similar with you as a fighter pilot, like it was probably in you from an early age. And so I had defined this purpose for my life. And I knew, even on my worst days, when I lost friends in combat or when men didn't come back from missions on things that I asked them to do, when my feet hit the floor in the morning, Justin, and I wore that uniform, I knew exactly who I was. I knew exactly what I was supposed to do. And I had no question about the purpose in my life. And then all of a sudden, you know, I'm walking around my house in flip-flops. You know, I am doing contract work, and everything that I thought I knew about the world was gone, like my purpose, my relevance. And I started to isolate, and it happened very quickly. And all of the guilt and all of the post-traumatic stress and everything that I had pushed down in order to stay in the fight just came flooding in. And within 6 months, I had spiraled down to a point where I thought I was losing my mind, you know, and come to find out I wasn't alone at all in that this is a common challenge that, you know, veterans have, is that we go from one planet to the other and we let the military keep part of our kit, which they're not allowed to keep, which is our purpose. And our passion for being relevant, that's ours. They don't get to keep that. And I allowed that to happen. So it was only reconnecting back to that through my story, through my personal story, that I found my way back into the sunlight. And so, you know, I would say to anyone listening to this, whether you're a Vietnam veteran or, you know, all the way, if you're still on active duty like you are, that transfer of purpose and relevance is paramount to being able to thrive at home.
Is there anything looking back that you could have done differently for somebody who is soon to be in your shoes?
What you're doing right now. What you're doing right now in terms of your podcast, but you are preparing for your transition. You are looking beyond the uniform and recognizing that the uniform, while it's great, it does not define us as a human being. It does not define who we are. It is a part of who we are, but it is not who we are. And by finding, I believe, other ways to express your purpose and your path. And this, look, this isn't just for the military. All of us go through change in life, right? So if you're listening to this and you want to become a baseball player, or you want to become a cellist, a world-class cellist, what we have to recognize is that it informs who we are, but it doesn't define it. And so the more work we can do while we're in that endeavor to explore at a deeper level who we are and what we're about, I think the more open we are on the other side of it to finding pathways. And so, you know, I wrote a book called Mission America, and the target audience that I wrote it for are guys like you who are still on active duty, still sticking and moving, but, you know, maybe once or twice a week, you put some thought to, okay, who am I as an individual? Why am I on this earth? And what purpose do I serve? And I think if we ask ourselves that on a recurring basis, while we're in the passion that we love, then we open ourselves up to opportunities on the other side.
Yeah, I think that's great the way you put that. So you wanted to be a Green Beret when you were 14 years old. What was your path from there to actually becoming one?
Well, I lived in a little logging town. So, you know, the path in that little logging town was a very, very basic one. You either stayed in that town and worked at the factory or cut billets, or you went to college or joined the Army. And, you know, I had a mentor named Mark who was a Green Beret captain. He walked into our soda shop one day when I was 14. He was on leave and he had his Class A's on, and I just knew that's me right there. Like, I had no idea what the dude was or what he did, but he was cool enough to sit down and talk with me. And I was a runt, man. I mean, I was scrawny. If you had seen pictures of me, you would have thought there's no way in the world that guy could go SF. But this guy, he saw through all that, and he sat down with me, and he basically explained to me that he was a Special Forces Detachment Commander and what he did. I just fell in love with it, the whole notion of helping the little guy stand up against the big guy and immersing yourself in those environments, and he really helped me map it out. He stayed my mentor all the way up until I retired, and he helped put out a path for me that I mean, literally, I started training right then. I went home and pulled down Encyclopedia Britannica, you know, old school Google. I started researching special forces, and he helped me put together a training plan. And I stuck to it. And I applied for an ROTC scholarship, and I got a 3-year, you know, put myself through school and got commissioned in a branch I did not want, which was quartermaster. I was furious, but I just stayed with it for a couple of years until I was eligible to try out for special forces. I went to tryouts. I made it, but then I got recycled several times in the course, and I stuck with it, didn't quit. And eventually, you know, I got my Green Beret and never looked back. But the path to get there, Justin, was probably 10 years. And I don't think that's uncommon today. One of my mentors, Bo Eason, says, you know, everybody that's a high performer needs a 10-year plan.
Mm-hmm. So it's not something that you can just join off the bat. To be in a Green Beret, you have to have experience in the Army first before you apply for it.
Well, there are always exceptions, right? And so the Special Forces Regiment put in place, and they've done it a couple of times, they call it the X-ray program. So it's for you, you can join Special Forces right out of high school. Now, I wanted to be a Special Forces officer, so I had to get my commission through college first, through ROTC. But Green Berets, like all Special Operations units, are sergeant heavy. Whereas where you fly in the squadrons, it's officer heavy. The officers fly the planes. But in special forces, the sergeants of a 12 person team, 10 of them are sergeants. And so, you know, anyone listening or watching this that wants to be a Green Beret or a SEAL, you know, the quickest path to that is to enlist and you know, become an NCO and go do that work. But for special forces, yes, there is a way to be an X-ray right out of high school, but it is kind of a minority program. It's not super common.
And as an officer, are you doing the same training going through as enlisted?
So the way they do it is everybody goes through selection. It's a 3-week tryout process together with no rank. And you go through that. And if you're selected, then they split you up into what they call MOSs. So you on a Special Forces A team, which is a 12 person team that goes into these places, you have a captain who's the commander. You have a warrant officer who's the detached assistant. You have a team sergeant who's the most senior guy on the team. He's an E8 sergeant. And you have an intelligence sergeant who's the assistant person. And then you have these, what they call MOSs. So you have two weapons guys, a senior and a junior, who can basically break down any weapon system in the military in the world blindfolded. You have engineer sergeants, junior and senior, who can build roads and bridges and then blow them up. You have two medical sergeants who can do everything from a battlefield appendectomy to pulling a tooth on an abscessed elder or an abscessed tooth on an elder. And then you have your communication sergeants who can write computer code and they can send Morse code. And all of those guys go to separate training after selection. They get their MOS training and then they come back together for tactics and they split up again and they go do deeper training. And about 18 months later, they come together one last time for this thing called Robin Sage. And it's the world's longest or biggest role-playing exercise where you're dropped in as a student team into what they call Pineland. It's 5 counties in North Carolina that are all, it's the largest role-playing exercise in the world. And it simulates a guerrilla warfare island. And if you make it through that, you get your Green Beret.
What are some principles or tenets of being a Green Beret that you learned there?
First one, well, there, you know, there's several that I really like. The first one, and I'm framing them with kind of a rooftop spin on it. But the first one is to get surrounded on purpose. You know, Green Berets, we believe that it is absolutely imperative that we immerse ourselves in the local environment. Kind of the old saying is go local or go home, where most organizations, most bosses, most leaders are going to come in and out of the problem. Top down, we're going to live in the problem. We're going to literally immerse ourselves in the environment, and then we're going to work from the inside out, right? So that's one. Another principle we have in Special Forces is to work yourself out of a job. Right. So if you want to be, rather than try to find out how you can, you know, stay at the top of the game and be irreplaceable, is look for ways for yourself to be replaced as soon as possible. Because what that does is it builds organic capacity for the people you're working with. So we want a host nation unit to be able to operate without us. So how do I make myself, you know, in a position where I can train them and then provide overwatch and then quietly step out of the way? That is, to me, a very, very different way of thinking about things. But if leaders thought that way, I think we would build much more autonomy in our organizations. And then finally, I would say, connect like your life depends on it. Humans are meaning-seeking, emotional, social creatures. We are wired for connection. And even in this day and age of social distancing and division in our country politically, the leader that owns the room is the leader that's the best at making connections and building relationships. And so training on that rather than using instinct, train on it as a skill, is going to be the most relevant person in the 21st century.
Yeah. Can you talk to training, building those relationships as a skill? Because I think a lot of people don't put much thought into that. And it seems like Green Beret is better than anybody else hone that as a skill and teach that.
Yeah, and we even have a problem with it, Justin, in the sense that during the post 9/11 era, you know, the Special Forces Regiment became somewhat divided on how we saw the world. You had some of them, like me, who are more of the Lawrencean type that believe that everything should be by, with, and through indigenous people. And then you had others in Special Forces, and they're still there, who say, no, we should be able to kick down doors and shoot bad guys in the face better than SEALs or anybody else. And so we've actually fallen victim to our, you know, to the attraction and the allure of tactical targeting. And that's not good, because that's not what we were designed to do. So spinning back to what you said, I think that that is representative of a larger problem here at home in our society. We tend to look at the skills of active listening, relationship building, rapport building, storytelling or narrative competence, or physical presence and mindfulness, human connection. We call those soft skills, right? And then everything else is a hard skill. So we'll train on the hard skills all day long. We'll train on how to read a balance sheet or the financials, or we'll train on how to shoot a weapon system to the cows come home. But we won't train on negotiations. We won't train on how to listen to a client and really see the pictures in their heads. But what we know now through a lot of new science is that, you know, even thinking through genealogy, the societies and bloodlines that last the longest are the ones who are better connectors, who form stronger relationships. Jackasses don't have very long bloodlines, you know, because it's just not, as humans, we're social creatures. We don't want to be around someone like that. We're going to separate ourselves from that person. And even if they are able to use coercion, right, to lead that way, it doesn't last very long, you know, in a genealogy type sense. So I say, let's stop calling them soft skills, and let's start calling them Lawrencean skills. These are the skills that Lawrence of Arabia used to mobilize thousands of, you know, tribal nomads to overthrow the Ottoman Empire in World War I. One dude. Now, you talk about a return on investment. So I'd like to see people training more on how they listen, train more on their narrative competence, the ability to use storytelling in real time to meet your goals, and on your ability to be physically present when you're in an engagement. That's what I teach in the qualification course. And, you know, I'm happy to go deeper on that here if you want to, on some things people can do. But like, if you want to own a room, if you want to move people to take action, that's how you do it.
Yeah, let's talk more about these Lawrencean skills, because kicking down a door and clearing a room, or for me, dropping a JDAM, isn't super relevant to most people out there. But these Lawrencean skills of leadership and active listening, I think, really are applicable. So let's talk, dive more into that.
Yeah, sure. So the first thing is, you know, I'm not saying that this should all be kumbaya, right? I'm not. Every leader should have a baseline level of coercion in them. So you should have the ability to swing the big stick, whatever that looks like in your world, if you need to. But that should be like the bot, that should be your baseline. That should be your final option. You should never lead with that. There's an old saying that says, if the only tool in your kit bag is a hammer, then every problem looks like a nail. And I think that's what's happened to us as a society, is that we have become accustomed to leading with coercion. And what that's done, Justin, is it's created a low trust, distracted, disengaged environment. I mean, look at the country today. You know, we're 77%, according to Gallup, believe the country is divided. That's the highest number at any point in our history. So how do you sell in that environment? How do you create investment opportunities? How do you even get your employees to follow your vision when you have a baseline 77% distrust level? Well, that's exactly what we walk into as Green Berets. And so what I say is, what do people respond to in a low trust, distracted, disengaged environment, what I call the churn? They respond to a leader who is relevant and relatable, right? Relevant and relatable, relevant to their pain, relevant to their goals, and who they look at as relatable and go, wow, she's like me, man. She's been scuffed up like I have. And you know what I'm talking about. Like when a leader gets in front of you and they share a story about where they made a mistake, or they did something wrong and what they learned, you automatically create, you connect with them, and reciprocity starts to happen. You start to feel like you want to do something for that leader. And that's biological. That's a quarter of a million years old. And so if we understand that most of the connections we make as leaders, it's below the surface. If humanity is an iceberg, all that coercive stuff, the PowerPoint decks and all that stuff, that's the tip of the iceberg. The real gold in how we lead is below the surface. And it's really, I think it boils down to like three things, I would say. Being a really good active listener. All right. I'll give one takeaway for that. Get good at asking thoughtful, open-ended questions that allow the other party to respond in narrative. So, for example, during this crisis, I coach my clients to say, hey, before we get started with this Zoom call, let's go around the horn. I want to hear from everybody. What's the best thing that's happened to you since our last call-in? What that's going to do, it's going to validate the other party. It's going to bring their emotional temperature down. And now they're ready to listen and physiologically hear what you have to say, because they're operating under a fear-based mindset. And until you bring that emotional temperature down, they can't hear you. I've rambled for a bit. I've got an example for story and physical presence too, but I'll pause there to see how that's landing on you, Justin.
Yeah, that totally makes sense to us, especially the part about being, I suppose, relatable. So we teach new instructors out here that you want to call yourself out when you make mistakes. You want to be hardest on yourself. And that establishes credibility so that the student will accept feedback when you give the feedback to them.
Yeah, because your whole premise with your podcast is on performance, like high performance. And Daniel Coyle, in his book Culture Code, he studied high-performing cultures all over the world. It's a great read. If you haven't checked it out, I highly recommend it. But one of the things that he distilled from that is that every high-performing culture they all have three things in common: psychological safety, a sense of human connection, and a shared vision, right? And so we could even ask ourselves as leaders, those are my highest metrics. How can I fulfill on that? Well, am I relevant? Am I relevant to the pain and the dreams of my people? And do they see me as relatable? Am I relatable? So we talk about vulnerability all the time. I know warriors have a hard time with that, and I get it, because that word, it's just almost counter to how we're trained. But to me, relatable is not. And if you're relatable, you will demonstrate the necessary levels of vulnerability without sticking your jugular out, mm-hmm. You know, and not become like a Pollyanna type model. So listening. And now, so from there, what are the three actual applications that, and there's more, but below the waterline, what are three skill sets that people could do? Listening is huge, and active listening. And the best one I've seen is open-ended questions. Get good at asking questions of your people as a leader. There used to be this train of thought that, like, if you asked a question, you seemed weak. But I don't think that's true at all. And most of the, you know, the science out there that's measuring brain activity, it actually elicits reciprocity and confidence in the other party. You know, so I would put some thought to the questions you ask yourself, the questions you ask your people, you know, and really, there's a great book by Warren Berger called Beautiful Questions that speaks to that. The second thing that I think is a Lorenzian skill is what I call narrative competence. And it's basically the utilization of storytelling in real time to meet your goals in an engagement, right? Humans are meaning-seeking, emotional, social story animals. We've been telling stories for over 100,000 years. In fact, there's recent evidence of a cataclysmic volcano in Indonesia that took the human race down to 10,000 people. And we believe that is when Homo sapiens started telling stories on how to survive coming out of that volcano. And ever since then, story and storytelling has become a psychotechnology to allow us to embed experiential lessons through a narrative that make us feel as if we were experiencing it ourselves. I do a TED talk called The Generosity of Scars if people want to check that out, but it really brings out how, like you as a fighter pilot instructor, you can go up to the PowerPoint slide, Justin, and you can show all day long about why this move's bad. But if you tell a story that allows us to step into your world and experience a moment where you made a move and it almost went badly and what that felt like, we autobiographically listen to that. And we now feel as if we've lived it. And that's how humans have evolved so fast, is our storytelling skills. So if you can harness the power of storytelling, I don't care what your profession is. Steve Jobs is right. The storyteller is going to own the world. I'll pause for your comment there.
Yeah, I'm curious. What are some things people can do to tell stories? Because absolutely, people relate to the emotion from stories and remember things much better than if you just give them facts.
Yeah. There are, on my website, rooftopleadership.com, I have a whole host of vlogs that are free on storytelling. That would be one thing. I encourage everyone watching this or listening to this to develop your own backstory, right? Every human on the planet should have their own backstory. And what do I mean by that? It's an origin story, or if you like Joseph Campbell's terminology, the hero's journey, right? It is the story that gives us a sense of who you are as a person. If you'll remember a little while back, I talked about being a scrawny kid in a small town in Arkansas and meeting Mark. That's my backstory. And that gives people a sense of who I am, where I've been in my life, what I stand for, and where I'm going. And it's a very simple framework. All you have to do is pick a pivotal moment in your life where you got your butt kicked. And just, we have plenty of them, but it's a defining moment where something happened in your life that totally changed the moment you were in. So maybe it was your mom and dad split up. Maybe it was changing schools. Maybe it was losing a loved one. Maybe it was joining the military, whatever. But it's a defining moment that changed the trajectory of your life. And usually, if you'll just be still with a piece of paper and a pen, it'll come to you pretty quick. Just trust your instincts and write about that defining moment, what it was, how it showed up, what life was like just for a few minutes before that defining moment. And then what was the struggle that ensued? Because the hero's journey basically goes like this. The hero hears a call. She reluctantly answers the call. She goes on a journey into the belly of the whale and fights a struggle against enemies that may be outside, inside, or both. She meets a guide along the way that helps her find her way home. She returns home to the home shore, and she shares those lessons and how she changed with the people on the home shore. It's a gift of transformation and knowledge. And that is psychotechnology. That is how storytelling has been used since that cataclysmic volcano. And so if you can, say, develop your own story that is, that pivotal moment, the struggle that ensued, how you overcame that struggle, was there a guide that came in, like Mark came in to help me, talk about that, and then what you learned and how you changed, that's it. And if you can develop that and write on it for just 10 minutes, get on your feet, tell it, sit back down, do some more editing, tell it to the trees, tell an inanimate object for a few minutes, and then eventually, within like 3 or 4 days, share it with someone close to you and watch what happens. And then just look for opportunities to share that story going forward. You'll be surprised how many times you can use it. And it will open you up to additional uses of story for other opportunities. And you can even do that same format, Justin, if you want to talk about a new employee that you just had that arrived and you want to, you know, share something about them, or if you want to recognize someone on your team who did a great accomplishment, tell their story and it will just elicit all kinds of validation.
Yeah, I thought I read that book by Joseph Campbell, The Hero's Journey. And afterwards, I realized every movie that you see is based off of this. So I was just walking around seeing that. So that was definitely surprising to me. But also seems like if you start with something that happened to you, you're using something authentic.
Yeah.
You're not pulling something off the shelf, some leadership book. You're starting at a core that is yourself and then building from there.
And remember, too, that most people have a hang up with talking about themselves. And that's okay. I get that, especially veterans and first responders. But here's the thing. And I was told this by one of my mentors. Stories are told in the service of other people. The whole reason that stories exist is to advance the human race. Right? We can sit around the fire at night and we can talk about the painful lessons of the day so that those around us can listen autobiographically and not have to experience it firsthand, but they can feel like they did. How cool is that? I mean, you talk about leadership. Like if you have the courage to repurpose your struggle, or as I say, leverage the generosity of your scars through narrative in the service of other people so that they don't have to, then that to me is the epitome of leadership. And you can use that approach with storytelling. All stories should be purposeful. They shouldn't be this one time at band camp. Like it should be really purposeful and designed to help other people. You can tell stories to articulate where the organization is on its journey. You can tell stories to recognize people for accomplishments. You can tell stories to clients or prospects to about another client and how you helped them. So there's all kinds of ways to use them, but it starts with your own origin story and then getting good at the process of telling stories. Don't just wing it. You got to practice. And then finally, I'll say, Justin, the other third Lorentzian skill, listening, storytelling, is physical presence. Can you be present in an engagement? Can you be available? We're so distracted these days. And now with social distancing, it's even harder that we're not connected to the people across from us. We're checking our phones. We're thinking about what we want to say next. And people at a semi-conscious level sense this and they shut down. And so when you lose that connection, you lose that reciprocity and you lose that value. So can we be more present when we are across from another party? And one of the best ways to do that is to really breathe and notice our breath when we're in that engagement and really listen with curiosity to hear what the other party has to say.
And it seems like that ties directly into active listening. If you are present, you're going to be able to listen.
Yeah, it does. In fact, the six steps that I teach in active listening, the first one is called attunement. And so that really is being attuned to the other party. Now, one other thing I'll say about physical presence, and this is true with our kids. So like if you're coming home from work and you're going to walk into your house and be around the kids, so you're changing environments. One of the things that we can do is what I call pre-engagement preparation. And I teach this in the qualification course, but basically it gets you ready to be available before you walk in the engagement. You do three lower body breaths. So three of those, and then out, and you close your eyes when you do it. And then you say out loud three times, "I have time." And then you ask yourself out loud three questions and you answer it. Who am I? I'm Scott Mann, husband, father, Green Beret. Why am I here? I'm here to come on this podcast and to help Justin's tribe understand how they can perform at the highest level. What do they need from me? They need my authenticity. They need my scars. They need everything I've got. And then you walk into the engagement. If you do that, you will show up really present and you will have left all the crap from the last engagement at the door.
I like that. It's extremely tough to stay in the present moment. I boxed at the Air Force Academy and it's in Colorado Springs where the Olympic Training Center is.
Yeah.
And they brought in sports psychologists and they worked on us with visualization, self-talk, breathing. I know you do a lot of, you're a certified breathing coach. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more to that?
Yeah. I mean, leadership is the management of energy. According to Professor James Clausen from Darden University, who I co-teach on a leadership course with Capital One. And I love that definition because I really believe that. I think that the management of our own energy and the management of the people we lead, the people we serve, Justin, is the essence of leadership. And energy, is always moving around, but we can deplete our energy if we don't learn to lead ourselves first. And what happens that I'm seeing with a lot of leaders today is they are so caught up in the rat race. They are so concerned with the external validation requirements of their world and just how hard they're running that we're distracted. According to Microsoft, the average attention span for a human is 8 seconds, and that's 1 second less than a goldfish. So we are so distracted. And it was really with the play that I learned the element of presence, of being available. Because in live theater, you have to be really present for your scene partner. And so I started taking that skill and integrating it into what I teach Green Berets, which is sounded kind of crazy, but it works with anybody. Is, at the core of being present and available to the other party, where they sense that you really get them and there's reciprocity. Breath is at the core of that, because when we are anxious, when we are nervous, when we are in a sympathetic fight, flight, or freeze state, which is so much of our life now, we look like we don't trust ourselves, and the other party gets that same sensation, so they don't trust us. So we have to go from sympathetic state down to parasympathetic state. So fight, flight, or freeze down to calm and connect. And breath is central to that. And as Dr. Belisa Vranich, my coach, teaches in Breathing for Warriors, breath, if you use breathing, diaphragmatic breathing, the vagus nerve sends a signal to the brain that says, everybody calm down. It's all good. Let's relax and sort this out. So you get away from that primal, lizard brain thinking into a more deliberate processing mode. And diaphragmatic breathing helps you do that. It also, if you are listening, like for example, if you're out talking right now, while we're talking, I want you to just notice your breath as we're talking. And if you start to listen to your breath or notice your breath while you're listening, you will actually listen better, right? You'll actually hear better. Another thing you can do is notice your feet on the floor. Notice where your hands are placed right now, right? Notice your feet on the floor. Notice your breath while you're in the engagement listening, and you'll pay more attention to the person across from you. So breath is core to how we listen and how we're present. And if we're talking, breath is also core to us staying engaged and delivering with emotion, right? If we're presenting and we start to get nervous and we forget what we're saying, it's probably because we held our breath. So all we need to do is just take a breath and our temperature will come down. So breathing is just central to all aspects of human engagement.
I like that. And we teach that as well, especially with tanking. For the first time, you have two airplanes touching each other. Students will be nervous and they'll be flying all over the place. So we teach, just wiggle your fingers, wiggle your toes, make sure you're breathing. And usually that calms them down a little bit.
Yeah, we are sensorial creatures, right? So we used to think that I would say, okay, I'm going to determine what my mindset is, and then my body will follow. We know now that it's really the other way around. It is the physical act of doing something that informs the brain, and then it pushes back down into an emotional response, right? So if you want to be calm during that refuel or during that SAT test or during that job interview or that presentation to the boss, if you do the pre-engagement prep that we talked about before you walk in the room, and then when you're in the room, ask yourself, am I breathing right now? And then you notice your breath, you notice your feet on the floor, you notice the temperature in the room, you come out of your head and back into your body. And when you're in your body, you look like you trust yourself. When you're in your head, you look like you don't, because you're in your head. And so we want to be in our body. And that, again, that's not kumbaya stuff. This is what we use to go into these tribal engagements where the other party has got their finger on their AK trigger. So if it works in life and death, it sure as hell works in life and business. And you guys use it, a version of it, to refuel in midair, which I've seen that once and I never want to see it again as a passenger. Why wouldn't we do this, Justin, in daily life?
And so what other projects are you working on right now?
Right now, we are focused at rooftop. So with the play, we had to put it on hold for obvious reasons. We were supposed to start a second year of touring, but we're excited to have it on Fox Nation. I hope people will pay attention and will go to lastoutplay.com to learn more about the play and when we'll be bringing it to their neck of the woods, because it's super powerful. On the for-profit side, on rooftop leadership, we are singularly focused, Justin, on helping those in the fight right now against the coronavirus, whether it's small business owners, those working at grocery stores, healthcare workers. We're focused on helping those leaders lead through this crisis, pulling lessons from the battlefield and our area of expertise on human connection. That's our focus. Now, specifically, we have a video series called Leading Through Chaos that's free that I can send you separately to push out to your people. And we also have one that we're releasing this Wednesday called Danger Close, Leading Yourself When Things Fall Apart. And then we're doing webinars every Wednesday night. This Wednesday, I've got 3 Green Berets on talking about adapt, overcome, improvise. And so if people just go to rooftopleadership.com, we're putting out a ton of content, man. And subscribe to our newsletter. We're not going to hit you up for stuff. We're putting out a ton of relevant content. And then the final thing is I'm working on my rooftop leadership book right now, which I'm super excited to get that done and out into the world. So we're running hard on content creation for human connection in this new world.
That's great. And I'll make sure to include links to your website in the show notes. Anything else to leave the audience with?
I would say coming out of this, we need to put some thought on not just how we're going to lead through this, but how we're going to lead on the other side of this. Whether you're a young person who is getting ready to start your journey to greatness, or whether you are like me, you know, kind of in the twilight of your run and you want to make the remaining time, or somewhere in between, like where you are, Justin, I think we need to put some thought to how we lead on the other side of this. And in particular, I think our emphasis and our skill set on human connection is going to be vital. We are becoming a society that operates in a tribal kind of way that's not good. We're operating around this churn mindset of distrust and disengagement and distraction. And hopefully this virus has woken us up to the fact that human connection, that's how we're wired. And the relevant leader, the one that's going to own the room, is the one that can best make connections and be relevant and relatable to the other party. And that is met with reciprocity, which is rewarded tenfold to you in how you go about it. But human connection is a skill. And how do we build that skill so that on the other side of this thing, we show up and make deeper connections with people? Because we're going to need it. We're going to need leaders that can do that. And just because we have high technology, that does not equal human connection.
Well, Scott, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. I think there's a lot of great information in here for people. So thank you. And I hope you stay safe out there.
Yeah. Thanks, Justin. It's been great. I appreciate everything that you're doing. I appreciate your pursuit of excellence. And I wish everybody the best out there. And if you need anything, rooftopleadership.com, we're here.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed it, you can review it on whatever platform you're listening to on. You can also follow me at Justin Fighter Pilot on Instagram, Justin Hazard Lee, that's Hazard with an S instead of a Z, on LinkedIn. And you can find my newsletter at professionalsplaybook.com. Today's episode was brought to you by Bremont, over-engineered watches for professionals. In the last few years, Bremont has taken over as the fighter pilot's watch. Their combination of precision, quality, and customer service is unmatched. You can see all their watches by going to Bremont.com. Today's episode was edited by Trevor Cabler. Again, thanks for listening. I'll talk to you in 2 weeks.